As long as we have told stories, we've had conspiracy theories. So no, it's not that weird that there are people out there who believe America is run by the deep state and there's a child sex ring in the basement of a Washington pizza parlor. Yes, the stories are weird and they're not true, but you're always going to find them. What is worth wondering about, though, is the impact of modern communications on all of these wild beliefs. Are we pouring gasoline onto theories like Pizzagate and QAnon and keeping them burning when they would otherwise peter out on their own? If these theories take root in enough minds, will we eventually start to find that some of those minds are willing to go further than others? And if that happens, do we end up with, America right now? Are there more believers in conspiracy theories than there's ever been before? Or does it just feel that way? And are they getting more dangerous, or do we just hear about it more often? And if we've always had conspiracy theories, then what's the original one? And where did that story come from? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Anna Merlin is a senior reporter at Gizmodo Media Group. She is the author of Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, is your country more obsessed with conspiracy theories than anywhere else in the world? Or does it just feel that way right now?
I don't think that it's safe to say that we are the most obsessed, but it certainly feels that way. And we are certainly uniquely able to broadcast our conspiracy theories because of our sort of stranglehold on the world media.
Yeah, well, why do I know about Pizzagate, for instance?
Great question. Why do you know about Pizzagate? You know about Pizzagate because it is very colorful and people could hardly resist writing about it, and B, because Pizzagate was an outgrowth of the frenzy around the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, which everybody sort of couldn't help but be pretty invested in.
So for those of us who blessedly have not dug into this thing, I think we all kind of know that like Pizzagate exists and it's a conspiracy theory in the United States. But how does something like that get started? Where did it come from?
Pizzagate was a conspiracy theory that a bunch of high-level Democratic politicians and political operatives were involved in a child sex trafficking ring that was headquartered in the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. That's a short version. What we know, and there was a really amazing investigative report about this that ran in Rolling Stone and on a website called Reveal, is that Pizzagate seems to have been born from a Facebook post written by a Missouri attorney named Cynthia Campbell. And basically, Cynthia Campbell was convinced that the investigation into Anthony Weiner, the ex-congressman who is being investigated for sending sexually explicit text messages to a 15-year-old, was in fact going to uncover this enormous sex trafficking scandal involving dozens and dozens of high-level politicians. And what we know, too, is that Cynthia Campbell's Facebook post got picked up and spread around by a mixture of real people and what we think are probably bot accounts. And so Pizzagate, because of this impossibly strange sort of mixture of factors, gained incredible speed and got to the point where it became world famous. It became discussed in every major media outlet. And at the end of this time, someone showed up at the pizza parlor with a gun.
What happened?
So the gunman was from North Carolina, and he had been watching YouTube videos about Pizzagate, and he started texting friends. We know this from court documents, and said, you know, that it was making him sick. And as he sat there watching YouTube and spiraling, he decided, I need to do something about this. He started texting his friends and asking them if they were, quote, up for raiding a pedo ring. And he said, possibly sacrificing the lives of a few for the lives of many, standing up against a corrupt system that kidnaps, tortures, and rapes babies and children in our own backyard. Goes on like that. So he left his own children sleeping in bed and climbed into the car and drove 350 miles to Washington, D.C., walked into Comet Ping Pong, the pizza place, with a gun, two guns, actually, one an AR-15, and fired a couple shots, which luckily did not hit anyone. We don't know what went through his mind, but we know that he rampaged through the restaurant looking for this basement where he thought these children were, that, as it turned out, didn't exist. Comet Ping Pong didn't have a basement. And eventually he gave up, put down his guns, stripped off his sweatshirt, went outside, and surrendered.
How does somebody end up taking a theory like this so seriously and having the belief in it embedded so firmly in their mind, I guess, that it leads them to do this. Like, I can understand people bullshitting on the internet. That's what they do. But how does it cross that line and become something that is real to so many people?
We have a lot of a whole mess of sort of conflicting studies about who believes in conspiracy theories and why. And it is this really potent mixture of your social, cultural, political background, your level of educational attainment, and sort of how well the political system in the country that you live has worked for you. You know, a lot of people who feel really disaffected or disenfranchised are more likely to buy into conspiracy theories. So in the case of the Pizzagate gunman, you know, we don't know quite what was going on with him. We have a few hints. We know that he was deeply religious. We know that he was a little bit naive about news coverage. We know that he was, again, radicalized is the only word for it, by repeated viewing of these propagandistic YouTube videos. But it's really hard to predict who is going to sort of dabble in conspiracy theories as a hobby on the internet and who is going to be driven to extreme action in the way that this man was.
You went to an event that was for Pizzagate truthers, I guess, if we want to call them that. Maybe not as serious as this man, but people who really believe this stuff enough to show up in real life. What's it like to meet these folks?
I would say that among the Pizzagate folks and a lot of other folks I met, I was really struck by the way that their beliefs were giving sort of meaning and purpose and urgency to their lives. You know, these were people who seemed like ordinary people to me, who became completely embroiled in what I think in some ways was a very exciting quest. And we see this now with QAnon conspiracy theorists too, where they really feel like they are part of something really major, that they are, you know, helping to expose something of global importance.
Give me an example of one of the people that you met, either at that rally or in your course of reporting on conspiracy theories, that sticks with you as a kind of example of who falls for this stuff.
Well, in America, we know that about 50% of us, or maybe one in three, believe in at least one conspiracy theory. So, you know, like most of us, quote unquote, fall for this. A lot of us have an investment in conspiracy theories. The people I met who were in sort of the deep end of the pool, for instance, a woman named Angel that I met at the Pizzagate rally, were people who felt directly affected by what was going on. They felt directly affected by corrupt politicians. They felt directly sort of offended by the idea of sex trafficking and a sex trafficking ring, and they felt that they were personally obligated to do something about it.
It's interesting that you mentioned that a lot of us kind of believe or at least dabble in one conspiracy theory or another, because I was going to ask you about the difference between conspiracy theories and conspiracy without the theories, kind of, because the one that my mind always goes to is the moon landing or the extra shooter for JFK. And there's like long lists of actual evidence that people engage in, you know, that the flag was stiff, or in the case of JFK, the evidence from the grassy knoll and all that kind of stuff. But there's actually something that they're based on here, whereas you just described to me that the restaurant didn't even have a basement. You know, are we getting further out there?
I actually don't think that we're getting further out there in America. And I'm qualified to talk about America. I'm not as qualified to talk about other countries. But we know that in America, conspiracy theories and their sort of grip on the country tend to wax and wane. And we tend to see them kind of flare up at times of like really extreme social upheaval and social change. And we also know in America specifically that there is such a keen interest and investment in conspiracy theories because there are so many actual conspiracies throughout American history. If a conspiracy theory is the suspicion that a group of people are working in secret against the common good, a conspiracy is when they're actually doing that. And among other things, Americans have examples of spying, disinformation, and really outrageous acts by the CIA, the NSA, the FBI against both foreign leaders and U.S. citizens, which has created this incredible amount of suspicion and trauma and paranoia that I came to believe we're never really going to be able to get rid of.
One of the things I found interesting in part of your book is sort of the origin of like the original conspiracy theory. Can you tell me about the great-great-great-grandfather of Pizzagate and all these other theories?
So there are historically, going back many hundreds of years, conspiracy theories about shadowy groups gathering at night underground to meet in secret and participate in ritual child abuse, torture, and murder to sort of solidify their bonds. There's a medieval historian named Michael Barbazat who pointed out that Pizzagate looks a lot like what is called the nocturnal ritual fantasy, which is a phrase coined by Norm Cohn, another historian. So the nocturnal ritual fantasy is this idea of these shadowy groups meeting in secret, right? And one of the most sort of pernicious and vicious examples of this is the blood libel, which is an accusation levied against Jews beginning in the Middle Ages that they were kidnapping and torturing Christian children to use their blood in our matzah meal for Passover. So the idea that evil people gather secretly to abuse children is something that has been with us for a really long time, and it tends to recur over and over.
How much of this involves money? Not necessarily maybe for the people who believe in this stuff, but for the people who are pushing it.
So there is definitely an interest in monetizing conspiracy theories, and I would argue that that is something that is relatively new. There is more of a pathway to monetize conspiracy theories than there used to be. Obviously, the most successful example of this is Alex Jones. Alex Jones built a pretty sophisticated media platform, and he also separately started a store called InfoWars Life that are these vitamin supplements, some of which are harmless and some of which are not, but all of which are very directly tied to this idea that his listeners are literally under siege physically as well as spiritually and politically, and so that they need, you know, vitamin supplements to protect them from the enemy. So we see monetization of conspiracy theories that way. We also see sort of an army of would-be Alex Joneses trying to monetize things like their YouTube, their Twitter, Periscope. You know, we see these people who seem to have an idea that they can turn their social media audiences into real financial gain. And in some cases, they seem to be succeeding.
How much of this can I blame social media for? I feel like I ask this question for a lot of things.
So I have a different view about this than, you know, like some conspiracy theory researchers that I really respect. I think social media has a fairly big role because it allows more people to see information that they would not otherwise have seen, and it has a way of flattening every source of information and making it look the same. So Facebook, you know, has tried to roll out these initiatives to flag disinformation, but it has been very sort of inconsistent and confused, and crucially, it did not happen until after the disaster of the 2016 elections and all the misinformation that we know was flowing through those. So I would say that I think social media has done a lot to promote things. It's also done a lot to bring conspiracy theories to the attention of journalists so that we write about them, which is both a positive because we debunk them and we write about where they came from, and a negative in that perhaps we do also aid in their spread. It's really hard to tell. So I think that social media is an enormous factor here.
You mentioned the misinformation around the 2016 election, and we have an election up here in Canada this year, so we're seeing some of that. Where is the line? Because like you said, Pizzagate kind of sprang out of the mess around the 2016 election, and then there's a line that kind of drifts over towards perhaps credible sources that say things that maybe happened and maybe didn't, and then you've got more opinion-based journalism, and at the other side of the spectrum is the actual facts. How do you tell the difference between conspiracy theory / misinformation / just opinion-based political writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard to tell sometimes what is a credible source of information. I am somebody who writes for an opinion-based journalism outlet. Gizmodo Media combines opinion and journalism. I would argue that we do not spread misinformation, and we never had, but have, but certainly not everyone would agree with me about that, right? So some of what you believe to be true or false, a smear, misinformation, the real story has to do with where you fall on the political spectrum. But we also know that there are genuinely divisive, polarizing news sources that work really hard to exploit divisions in American life. We do know that. But identifying them can be really, really difficult.
Well, yeah, that was my next question, is how do you fight this? Is there a way to sort of start walking back some of these more outlandish conspiracies, or do you have to kind of wait for it to wax and wane, like you said?
I would argue, and I understand that this is not a popular argument, that the way to address conspiracy theories, specifically in American life, is to build a more just, transparent, and free society, because so many of the conspiracy theories that we hold as Americans have to do with a sense of being locked out of a very opaque political and financial system and healthcare system. I would also say, and people don't like this either, that there are always going to be conspiracy theories and some amount of misinformation. I think that is part of having a vibrant environment of free speech and free expression and free exchange of ideas. So what we need to figure out is, how do we put conspiracy theories and other forms of misinformation sort of back where they usually are for the more stable parts of our history, where they are part of the discourse, but they don't derail it?
Were there any theories in the course of reporting this book that you found yourself intrigued by or getting attracted to?
I mean, I went into writing this book believing that aliens are probably real, and so I still believe that. Yeah.
Why are aliens real? We have to end the podcast with this now.
I would say that we have a number of pretty good arguments for believing that aliens are probably real, and that we probably do not know everything that the world's governments know about alien technology or alien visitation. So aliens are probably real because the idea that we are completely alone in the universe is statistically unlikely, right? We also know that both the governments of the US and the UK, at the very least, have had a really keen interest in trying to identify UFOs and figure out what they are and study technologies that they believe might be alien technologies, or at the very least, technologies whose source here on Earth has not yet been identified. And we know that in part because at the end of 2017, just to name one example out of dozens, a secret Department of Defense program was revealed that was doing just that, was studying possible alien technologies. So that's one that is pretty non-controversial for me, though, of course, you know, there are a lot of permutations of it that I don't necessarily believe.
This is fantastic because I came into this interview expecting to get everything debunked. And now I have something that I can go on YouTube and watch videos about. What is the most unexpected thing you learned or found while reporting this book?
This is a really prosaic example, but I was... One of my chapters is about redemption theory, which is a branch of sovereign citizenry that essentially tries to get out of paying taxes. Like, it's essentially a belief that the government is holding secret money in your name, and if you do the right set of legal maneuvers, you can get access to this secret bank account that's held by the government, and you can, in some cases, get out of paying federal taxes. So the thing that surprised me about this is that there is a whole army of IRS agents who are devoted to investigating these people and trying to charge them with fraud, because a lot of times redemption theorists end up committing tax fraud, but that those IRS agents use fake names and fake identities in order to investigate, which I thought was fascinating. They have reasons why they do it, but at the same time, it is something that directly feeds people's paranoia about the financial system and the IRS and the US government. So that was fascinating to me.
It is literally a conspiracy theory investigating people who believe in conspiracy theories. Thanks so much for taking the time, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Merlin, senior reporter at Gizmodo Media Group and author of Republic of Lies. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head over to thebigstorypodcast.ca and check out some of our other episodes or suggest one you'd like us to cover. Feel free to find us on social media at Frequency Pods on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And as always, everywhere you get your podcasts, we're there too. From Apple to Google to Stitcher to Spotify, we want a rating and a review. Claire Broussard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers. And Elisa Nielsen is our digital editor, and she's who you're talking to if you hit us up on social media. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Enjoy the long weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.